To love learning. To laugh.
To love.
To be loved. To see beauty.
To understand.
To bring grace.
To the things that matter most.
This is Psychology America with Dr. Alexandra. Welcome to my show. For every life stage, we have questions. Let's enhance our lives together as we explore the things that matter most. I've always started my podcast with a dedication, most often to a human service nonprofit that I appreciate. But today, as a psychologist and as a human, I want to recognize the recent deaths of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery. And I want to recognize the traumatic stress that many of us all over the world, especially minorities, have experienced in response and are experiencing in response to their recent deaths. It hurts. We have people from over 120 countries listening to this podcast, and each of us has or had a mother, as George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery did. And each of us, no matter where we're from or what our color is, each of us wants well-being and peace for ourselves, our children, our loved ones. We want that. And what can we do? How can we encourage this sense of peace and safety, fairness in all people? We might have ideas about causes, but in reality, each of us can only do what's in our own sphere of influence, as Duke Professor Tony Brown says. Think about it and what your sphere of influence is in your world and what you can proactively do in a small way today, this week. What can you do to encourage or give someone you know the encouragement they need? With that said, let's begin this episode. Dr. Kendall Shortway, PsyD, is the co-author of the Routledge Handbook of Clinical Sports Psychology, which is in publication to come out sometime this year, 2020. Congratulations, Dr. Kendall.
Thank you so much.
And you also teach and serve as research coordinator at Kane University. And much of your very interesting research has focused on sports psychology. And we also have with us Neil Clark, former NCAA Division I track and field athlete and cross country, and currently a master's competitive athlete in running and swimming, running coach and attorney. Hi, Neil.
Hey, good morning.
Kendall, I first met your mom, who's a lacrosse coach. My daughter, Sarah, a freshman in high school, decided to take up lacrosse for the first time this year, and we quickly realized she needed to learn the basics, like catching the ball. And we needed a coach, and that's how we came across your mom, Sherry, who co-owns a private company with her husband, Harry, to teach lacrosse. And I struck up a conversation with her. And when she learned that I'm a psychologist, she wanted to tell me about you and the very interesting research that you're doing on New Jersey coaches' reactions to non-binary athletes. So before we get into that, Kendall, I just have a question. I noticed that you and your mom spell your names in very different ways. You spell your name K-E-N-D-A-H-L, and she spells her name Sherry, C-H-E-R-I-E. And I was wondering if you could talk about your name and what you know about your name.
Sure. It is a very different spelling, especially speaking of my name, Kendall, because it is typically D-A-L or D-A-L-L. I don't exactly know why my parents decided to include an H. I often tell people that it's a silent H. But I am glad that it's unique. And I think that in some ways, it could tie into our discussion today about a gender in the sense that it's somewhat of a gender neutral name, that I've met both girls and boys and men and women who have the same name as me.
That does tie into our discussion. Yes. And the title of your most recent research is New Jersey Coaches and Athletic Directors Perspectives, Gender Non-Binary Athletes.
Yes.
And this research has almost 900 New Jersey athletic directors, coaches, assistant coaches. But before we get into that and the results of it, I think we should talk about background, starting with what does gender non-binary mean?
Sure. So gender non-binary is in some ways an umbrella term. Sometimes people use it synonymously with gender non-conforming, means that someone identifies in ways that is outside of the gender binary. And the gender binary is male, female, or man, woman, boy, girl. So people who identify as non-binary don't identify within that binary and are otherwise somewhere on the spectrum and may use other terms too, like demigender or transgender, gender fluid, gender queer, etc.
And my understanding is that transgender is under the umbrella of non-binary. It's not this exactly the same thing. It's just under the umbrella. Can you help with the distinction?
Sure. And it's probably worth mentioning too that people identify in different ways. So you might have someone who identifies as transgender and they would consider themselves gender non-binary, but there's also people who identify as transgender, maybe trans man, trans woman, and they don't necessarily also consider themselves gender non-binary. So it is something very unique to each person and how they interpret and understand and experience their gender. Someone who is transgender experiences their gender and identifies their gender differently than what they were assigned at birth. So maybe someone was born and they were labeled to be female, and then throughout their life at some point, they identify differently. And so they are transgender.
Right.
Because their gender does not align with what they were assigned at birth.
And it might be helpful to identify some other terms like cisgender, what that means.
Definitely. So I identify as a cisgender woman. So what cisgender means is that the gender the person's assigned at birth does align with the gender that they identify with and they experience. So for example, I was born and assigned to be female. I was raised as a girl, I was socialized as a being a girl, and now as a woman, I continue to identify that way. So there was never any discrepancy between how I was treated and how I was socialized and how I was viewed and how I deeply identify with my gender.
Yeah. I want to admit to you and to listeners that when I first created the title to this podcast or the concept of this podcast, I had lumped the transgender folks into the group of gay and lesbian. Mm-hmm. I had automatically lumped them together. And I realized when I started reading more about it that they should not necessarily be in the same group.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, many say they are not in the same group at all.
Yeah. So, and I'm really glad you bring that up. And I really appreciate your humility with saying that. I can relate because we're all learning all of the time. And I want to say here too, with everything we're talking about, I really owe it to so many of my clients, my students, other educators, speakers, authors, so many people who've shared their lived experience to help many of us understand. And these terms are constantly evolving and changing. And so we really all are in the process of learning. So I do appreciate, you know, you acknowledging that. And it's true, a lot of people, especially when we hear LGBTQ or LGBTQA plus, that people maybe make the assumption that that's all related to the same thing. What all of those labels and identities and orientations have in common is that they are marginalized in some way and historically and currently oppressed in some way as sexual orientations and gender identities. But they truly are very different. We each have a sexual orientation and we each have a gender identity. So those are two different aspects of a person's experience and identity.
Yes, you're bringing up something that I've thought about in one of the podcasts I recorded called Narcissistic Personality Disorder with Nancy McWilliams. We talked about how people have their own inward reality of who they are. Mm-hmm. And then they have what's called the persona, which is the image they want to present to the world. And people can really work on and create a persona that's not connected to the reality of who they are. And they can do that through social media, even more so now. Mm-hmm. I think it's similar for any of us when it comes to how our gender identity can be different than our gender expression. And this is so linked to a lot of concepts and conversation about women's rights and unspoken cultural rules about how women are supposed to behave and how men are supposed to behave. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot there that we could talk about. You bring up a lot of important points. And one thing I would say is there's also a difference for many people in their gender expression and their experience of their gender. So I think it makes sense, especially for people who are first learning about this or trying to understand, it could seem like a person's identifying their gender in a way that doesn't fit with the way that they're expressing their gender, but that's not necessarily the case. I mean, I try to understand it more that it is the person's gender. So their experience of their gender, that is their gender.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, sure. So let's say that there's someone who identifies as, we'll say, gender non-binary. Okay. So they're outside of that binary of you're either this or you're that. And instead that they are somewhere in the gender continuum. And that's how they identify their gender. So I would say it's not so much that that's a persona that they're creating that doesn't align with how society or people in their life may see them. I would say that is their gender. And then it's up to the other people in their life and society to realize that, to try to understand that, and to affirm that. When there's a lack of that is really where there's more distress for the person who's not being accepted for the gender that they identify with.
Right. I think what I'm thinking of is when most definitely, I mean, this is much broader than talking about any particular population. Who we are isn't always aligned with what we present to the world. And I think we can have more of a sense of peace if we can truly be who we want to be.
Sure. Definitely.
As long as, you know, that includes abiding by the law and being kind to other people, et cetera, right? But I think what I'm talking about is the work of trying to present something that you're not to the world.
Right.
Maybe by social media.
Yeah, and if I could pick up on that, I think that part of what we express has to do with the way we perceive the tolerance of the rest of the world to what we express. So I'll give an example. Probably 30 years ago, if a man exhibited, you know, traits of real sensitivity, and those were assigned sort of feminine qualities, and there was less tolerance for that. But what I found is we've now, thankfully, have a broader definition, so to speak, of what it is to express maleness.
Right.
And so now I think that part of the work to get people to feel comfortable expressing various facets of their identity and having kind of a broad acceptance of that. So, you know, as example, I'm a cisgender male that identifies male, but probably in ways that I express myself as a male, if I did that 30 years ago, people would think that I was feminine.
Right.
And thankfully, we've moved on from that. And I think I gather that the work that has to be done so that people feel more comfortable in their expression is really the work of sort of social and political work that has to change so that people do feel more confident to express what they really want to express without feeling that they'll get criticized or shunned for doing so.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's it. Thank you, Neil.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really well said. And and not, I mean, yeah, criticized. And also there's ways that people who experience their gender and identify outside the gender binary have basically been made invisible, you know, through research. Even with the census 2020, the options are male, female. So it's devastating and not surprising that we do see high levels of distress for people who are not able to be in those contexts where they can express and identify their gender with what's really true to them. It can lead to a lot of difficulties for these people because of the way, exactly, I think what Neil said, of not creating socially, politically, just in our homes and in the context we all live in, that they're not fully affirmed or accepted.
I want to bring up a point, though, that I think people think about, and it's a valid and important thing to bring up, and that is the biological differences between men and women. I want to just talk about that because, and our sexuality, which is partially defined by outward anatomy by most standards, like you were talking about, when you're born, you're assigned a sex, right? And it's also defined by our chromosomes, our hormones, and the brain is considered a sex organ. And the hippocampus in women is larger than in men. The amygdala is larger in men than in women. And I want to share a study about rats, if that's okay, because I find it interesting.
Sure.
And worthwhile for the conversation. And I read that in rats, the anterior hypothalamus is larger in males than in females. And the development of that depends on testosterone levels before and after their birth. So if male rat babies, known as pups, if they're castrated right after they're born, they show less of the male type sexual behavior. And if you inject testosterone into female rat pups, it enlarges this particular brain area and they show more of the male sexual behavior, like mounting other rats. And I don't want this part to go unsaid because that is a big part of the conversation when it comes to athletics, which we're about to talk, you know, when we talk about your study. I'm not ready to talk about your study yet because I feel like people still need more background. What do you think?
Sure. Yeah. With bringing up that study, so there's a debate, which I'm sure many people are aware of, or maybe not, when we talk about gender and we talk about sex and we talk about sexual orientation, there's sometimes controversy about how we study and understand the human experience. And the study sounds fascinating, and I would definitely have to read it and understand more about the method before really commenting on it.
Like a good scientist?
I do think it's worth mentioning, too, gender is a construct in the sense that it's something that we're socialized into. So we do, of course, have our biology and our anatomy and our hormonal levels, and all of that is so important to understand and may relate in some ways to our gender and our sexual orientation. And the difference between the rats and the humans is all of our environment and our social experience. And
true.
And yeah, we're taught so much about our gender and how we express it and gender norms and rules and expectations really through our society and our lived experiences. So I think that is worth mentioning, of course, looking at this from different perspectives and considering the research, maybe animal-related research or genetic research, and also really emphasizing that gender is a social construct. And so it's something that in that way is unique to the human experience and really plays out through the way that our environment influences us.
Yes. I think it's all of it. Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to include, you know, some of these biological things, because I don't want to exclude that from the conversation, in other words. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think when we get into the athletic realm, it by nature of it, it's an athletic competition that relies upon the physical attributes of the participants, and there is biology involved in that. And so I think it seems, at least in what I've looked at, that the biological part does take on a kind of renewed importance, because I know, and you know, we'll get into this, that what they're trying to do when they come up with these rules about transgender participation in sports, they're, you know, trying to balance, you know, the autonomy of the individual who, you know, wants to express their gender identity with the rules of fair competition. And I know that, so in the fair competition part of it looks at the biology, and then, you know, the autonomy part looks at, let's try to, you know, allow a person to participate on the team that is aligned with how they want to express their gender.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to make one last point before we move on to your study.
Sure.
And that is, again, that gender identity is separate from sexual or romantic orientation, which I mentioned. It's like two separate things.
Yeah. And I don't know if you think it would be helpful. We can go through some of the other terms to help differentiate the two, if that's helpful.
That would be helpful. And then we can go to your study. Sounds great. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So we can start with going through LGBTQA. And there's a plus because there's so many more terms and identities. And as I mentioned earlier, these change. And so I know in my experience in practicing therapy, there's times when I would be working with, say, one of my clients who's a teenager, and they reference something I've never heard of before. And it's like, wait, what's that one? So it's okay that they change, and we're all continuously learning. But so going through, we'll go through LGBTQ.
Okay.
And A.
Thank you.
So yeah, thank you. So L is lesbian. So that's referring to women who are romantically or sexually attracted to other women. The G is gay, and that typically refers to men who are romantically or sexually attracted to other men. However, sometimes women will also use the term gay. So they may identify as a gay woman, meaning that they're attracted to other women.
Yes.
So again, it shows too, even over time, and in some ways this intersects with age and age cohort and how these terms also evolve over time. B is bisexual. So that is someone who is romantically or sexually attracted to either gender. So either as in looking at the gender binary. So maybe both men and women. And there are a lot of misconceptions around people who identify as bi, just because they're attracted to both genders, it doesn't mean that they are polyamorous or polygamous or do, you know, constantly engaging in that. Someone could be in a long-term committed relationship with one person and still identify as bi, because it means mm-hmm. that they're attracted to both genders. However, that doesn't mean they can't commit to one person in the same way anyone who would be able to if that's what they wanted.
Right.
T, which is trans and transgender, which we spoke a bit about earlier. And then the Q stands for queer or questioning. And Q can relate to either sexual orientation or gender identity. And again, speaking of the intersection here with age, queer historically was a term that was used against people who identify in ways that were marginalized or oppressed sexual orientations or gender identities. And more recently, so especially with younger people, queer has been, I guess, used in more affirming ways of people will choose to identify as queer. So there are important differences. And again, it just really speaks to it's important how a person identifies and not how someone else labels them. And Q could also relate to questioning. So maybe someone who doesn't want to identify strictly in one way, or maybe they're currently exploring that for themselves and they would identify as questioning if that's what they feel speaks to them.
Yes.
Yeah. And then A is asexual. So that's someone who is not interested or does not feel a need for sexual activity or sexual relationships. A also can be agender. So that would be someone who doesn't identify with a gender orientation or having a gender. And then again, the plus is because there are a lot of other terms that can fit with someone's gender identity or sexual orientation.
Yeah. And there's a part of me, as I listen to this, I think about a patient of mine who says, why does everyone think it's their business to ask me if I'm gay?
Yeah. So feeling the need, like there needs to be some sort of like a pressure to tell others about their sexual orientation.
Or, you know, this patient is more feminine. Mm-hmm. He's more on the feminine side of things. So he gets questioned a lot. And I think it's just people being uncomfortable with a man not strictly having male behavior or the traditional man behavior in the Northeast of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it speaks to that point again, how we, our gender identity is different than our sexual orientation and also our gender expression. And I think this is really relevant to sports in what women have experienced in sports, where especially when sports were becoming more available to, say, girls in high school or youth sports, because not that long ago, there really weren't that many options for sports, that when girls did play sports, they would be labeled that they must be lesbians or all types of words that were meant to be derogatory, which is problematic in itself because that shouldn't be used as an insult. But it was basically saying, wait a minute, like the way that you're expressing your gender or you're not really following the gender rules here of what society expects of you. So now we're going to label you a certain way when, you know, hopefully we all realize now, like you can have any sexual orientation, any gender identity, you can express your gender in different ways. It really has nothing to do with, I mean, in some ways it may relate to, but mostly it has nothing to do with what sports that you enjoy.
I think it was only the early 90s that the Senate changed a rule that women had to wear skirts. I forget if it was the House of Representatives or the Senate, but it was a rule they had to wear skirts and then they changed it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. Yeah, the question of skirts is a great one, especially talking about sports like lacrosse and also field hockey where kilts or skirts have traditionally been worn. And it's really, I think, all about what people choose for themselves. So there are some teams where they may choose to still wear the skirts or the kilts, and it's because they want to.
Right. That's the difference.
Yeah, they want to.
Do you want to? Right.
Right.
So let's start and talk about this research that you did.
Yeah. And so I also want to give a lot of credit to the graduate students who have worked on this and are continuing to work on this research project with me. So Sam McSpirit, Dana Mattioli, and Victoria Garcia, they are all students in our school psychology program. So they are future school psychologists.
Yes.
And really, the heart of this study, this was really Sam McSpirit's idea. We had been meeting and talking about how he wanted to be involved in research. He is an athlete and also a coach and was aware of my sports psychology related interest. And so in brainstorming, this is what we decided would be really important for us to take on as a research question, which is really the broad research question. What do the coaches and athletic directors think about how high school athletes should participate in sports if they identify as gender non-binary?
Mm-hmm.
And for listeners who may not be aware, this has been really controversial. So within the United States, one place that receives a lot of media attention around this is Connecticut, because there are athletes who were really high performing and winning and competitive, and other athletes, and I mean the community, other people, had a real problem with it because these were athletes who were assigned male at birth and now were competing against girls.
In which sport was this?
Track and field.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just one example. It's happened all around the country that, you know, this was one that received a lot of media attention. And we, you know, as researchers, especially, we're trying to be as non-biased as possible. We were really curious. You know, there is a question of fairness and safety. I know, as Neil mentioned earlier, you know, there can be anatomical differences that in a competitive environment, it does seem like, wait a minute, maybe this isn't fair. But in, I guess to back it up a little bit too, just policy-wise, so there are differences by state. In New Jersey, mm-hmm. a high school athlete is allowed to compete on the team that they choose to compete on. They're just not allowed to compete with both. So for example, if an athlete wanted to compete on the girls' basketball team and that aligned with their gender identity, they cannot also participate on the boys' basketball team. You know, they have to choose one,
yes.
but they are allowed to compete with the team that aligns with the gender they identify with. There is an option for others to appeal that, but that is the rule. And just a larger federal law with this relates to Title IX, which is a federal civil rights law, 1972, which you can't have exclusion or discrimination based on sex.
Yes.
So yeah, just kind of holding in this current context, you know, there's new policies unfolding, there's controversy. We said, what do the coaches and athletic directors think? Because arguably, these are the people, the adults at least, that are most involved and also invested in how high school sports play out.
Right.
And so we said, okay, there's all these policies, but what do they actually think?
That was a good research question. And I want to mention that I appreciate that you mentioned the graduate students. That was nice.
Yeah. I couldn't not mention them. They have been amazing to work with. And I should say too, the study, we're still in the process of it because we also have a lot of qualitative information.
Yes.
So we are going through coding the qualitative, the open-ended responses, which we have so many because a lot of people had really strong views about this.
Yeah.
So we're still in the process of doing that and coding and so that we can disseminate our findings.
What was the main question that you had mentioned in the poster again?
Yeah. And actually, if I can just rewind a little, I'll speak a little more about the method to get to that question.
Yeah.
So we were able to put together a list of New Jersey high school athletic directors and coaches all through their email addresses that were accessible in the public domain. So there were many, over 6,000. And we included both private and public high schools and across all 21 counties in New Jersey. So we really wanted to get as representative as possible all of the coaches and athletic directors involved in New Jersey high school sports. And they were sent a link to take an online survey. Mm-hmm. The survey included information about who they are. So we typically call those their demographic variables. And they were randomly assigned to one of two vignettes. So a vignette is like a short story that people can read and respond to. So half of them received a vignette where, and it's not too long. Maybe I should just read the vignette. It might be easier to understand.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So half of the participants in the study received a vignette that said, "You are a coach of a high school girls sports team and a sophomore athlete who identifies as gender non-binary is interested in joining the team. The athlete was sex assigned male at birth and identified as male up to freshman year. As they transitioned into freshman year, they started to identify as gender non-binary. They really want to participate on a sports team and they grew up playing various sports with boys teams. Currently, they feel more comfortable playing on the girls team and their friends, family members, and teachers identify them as non-binary." We also included terms so that the terms were available to read while the vignette was visible on the survey in case someone wasn't sure about what gender non-binary meant.
Mm-hmm. Good decision.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then the other half were randomly assigned where the athlete was on the opposing team.
Yeah. So in the first case, they have what many people would say, okay, I've got the advantage. I'm going to say what I think a lot of people are thinking.
Exactly. Yeah, because that was one of our hypotheses.
Right.
We expected that if the athlete was on your team, maybe you thought the athlete should be allowed to compete and that it was fair versus if the athlete was on the opposing team. And spoiler alert, that was not a significant finding. There was no significant, statistically significant difference regardless of which vignette the participants read.
Okay. So read the second vignette, please.
So the only difference in the second vignette is the first sentence. It would be, "You're a coach of a high school girls sports team. A sophomore athlete who identifies as gender non-binary is interested in joining the opposite team." So in other words, you'd be playing against that team or competing against that team. So the participants read the vignette and then they responded to questions. The questions that were our main interest as they relate to our hypotheses is that on a Likert type scale, meaning there's a range of responses that they could have chosen.
Yeah.
The statements were the athletes should be allowed to participate on the girls' team, and the range was strongly agree to strongly disagree. It is fair for the athlete to participate on the girls' team, and it's fair for the athlete to participate on only certain girls' teams. Because we thought, well, some people might think, you know, maybe basketball is different than wrestling, is different than cross country, etc.
Yes, that's a good question.
Yeah, so we had a great response rate. We were very excited. So many people started the survey, many completed. So we had, pulling up here, so we had 1,319 participants start the survey, which we were very excited about, and 825 completed the survey. So yeah, so it was a pretty good response rate.
It's a good number, statistically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also worth mentioning that the participants did represent all 21 counties, and pretty much as would be expected. So counties that are more densely populated, there were more participants from those counties. So some had much less representation, like only maybe 3 people in certain counties, but it did kind of align with the population of those counties. Mm-hmm. So with the questions that were of main interest to us because they related to our hypotheses, as I mentioned, there wasn't a significant difference. It didn't matter if the athlete was on like the coach or athletic director's team or the opposing team. There was no significant difference with that. And what we found is that many people did not think that the athlete should be allowed to participate on the girls' team. And this is, again, like part of why we wanted to do this study, because technically, according to policy, the athlete should be allowed to participate on the girls' team. But we found in our study that over 50% of the sample somewhat disagreed or strongly disagreed to that statement. They did not think the athlete should be allowed to participate on the girls' team.
Yep, that's what you learned.
Right. And so, yeah, there's other questions we included in the survey. We asked if they had ever received any type of training related to LGBTQ plus students. And we found that a majority of the participants had. And so that's something too we're thinking about. Okay, so there's training out there, and many of them said it was through professional development days. Some of them, it was something they saw on their own.
Yeah, and I recall, I think this may, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you found that there was a relationship between those that received training and their response that they, I think, strongly disagree that the athlete should be able to participate on the women's team. And I found that actually what I would not have expected.
Yeah, same here. We thought that there would be some sort of correlation between having training and believing that the athlete should participate on the girls' team, but that was not significant. The training did not relate to that. But I will say, and this is part of what we're doing through our coding now, we really have to try to understand the quantity and the quality of what the training meant. So in other words, was this something mandated that they had to sit through? That might have been a different experience than people who were really choosing to learn more and educate themselves and learn about how this affects the students that they work with.
I'd like to talk about what are the sticking points. What is it that people did get upset about in Connecticut, or what are their perceptions?
Yeah, so I don't want to speak for the people in Connecticut, but from what I've read about, it is the question of fairness. And with our sample being in New Jersey, we did see a lot of that. So some of the, many of the open-ended responses, so a lot of our items had options for people to explain their answers or provide more information. And a lot of people took advantage of that, which was very exciting because I love qualitative data.
Yeah.
and really understanding more about why people respond or think the way that they do. And I would say the vast majority of responses had to do with competitive fairness would be the majority. And then there were also a lot of people who just seemed to believe a certain thing. So there were sentences like science is science, or, you know, There's only male and female, very strong beliefs. And Well, that may sound discouraging for some of the listeners. I do also want to emphasize there were other responses where people said sport participation is about people feeling included and having opportunities. And there are people that believe ultimately it is up to the athlete which team that they choose to participate on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think also on something that something just worth sharing is that one of the other statements we had participants rate their agreement on was that coaches and administrators should use gender pronouns as identified by the athletes. And 68% of the participants selected strongly agree or somewhat agree to that.
Okay.
And so what that tells us a little bit is that, okay, over half of the participants, over half of the sample acknowledges that students can and should identify their own gender. And that coaches and administrators should use the gender pronouns as identified by the athletes. And over 50% didn't think that the athletes should be allowed to participate on the girls' team. So it does seem to be related to this question of fairness and safety, really like competition.
Right.
Maybe not so much about not wanting to affirm or accept the student's gender.
Yeah, I think on the fairness issue, and I looked at this when I wanted to pull up what the NCAA has done and then also what the IOC, International Olympic Committee, has done on this issue. And it looks like they were trying to strike that balance between, you know, as we talked about, allowing the athlete the autonomy of their gender identity, but also trying to, you know, the topic of fairness. And so I know with on the IOC level, they get down to even, you know, for a trans female, someone transitioning from male to female, you know, they even require sort of testosterone levels to try to investigate the relationship between testosterone and performance. And that's been, you know, a thorny subject, to say the least. But I know that's how they came down on it, is to, you know, if the athlete has certain levels of testosterone and has done so for about a year or so, then a, you know, trans female would be allowed to participate on a female team. And I think the NCAA has sort of done the same thing. It looks to me that what they've done, and this kind of goes into your, you know, as we started to talk about the definition between gender non-binary and trans, it looks to me as if the NCAA has required the athlete to kind of make a choice. And so for a trans female, they have to currently be treated with testosterone suppression and also can't compete for, I think, one calendar year.
Right.
And so in the high school level, I don't know how you would get a child under the age of 18 to undergo testosterone suppression if that athlete wants to participate on the female team.
Yeah. Yeah. I think thorny is a great word for it. It's been, yeah, really difficult. And I think the decision-making and so much controversy surrounding this. And in New Jersey, the policy used to be that there needed to be something to, like, quote unquote, legitimize the gender. So yeah, a physician, something from a physician, or, you know, much more consideration of, like, biologically what's happening that we can say that this student should be allowed to participate with this team. That has changed. You know, as I said earlier, that's no longer needed in New Jersey. But it doesn't mean that, you know, going back to our research, it doesn't mean that coaches and athletic directors agree with that. And what really concerns us, and I know what Sam and Dana and Victoria, myself, what we talk about is what are all the things we're not seeing? So, you know, that might be policy on paper, but what are the other ways that these high schoolers may feel like they cannot participate in sports? You know, what are the subtle and not so subtle ways that they may be facing discrimination that's really taking them away from being able to participate in sports? Because it may be policy on paper, but we're concerned about how this plays out in high schoolers' lives.
It's a battle of values between winning and losing, right? Versus letting the child participate. And winning and losing can mean money, right? Ego.
Sure. Yeah.
That all comes into play also.
And I know for some, you know, I try to see all sides of the argument on some level. I know for some athletes, their concerns are about college scholarships,
right,
college opportunities. So if you think if you're competing, especially at a higher level, say a state tournament, and you didn't win, and you really deeply believed that there was some sort of biological or physiological difference, and now maybe you're not getting the stats or the accolades that could make you more visible for college recruiters. So there are a lot of aspects where we could see how it's about a student being able to identify as they identify and being allowed to participate in sports.
And we all know sports are wonderful. They are so good for our health, for our mental health, and everyone should do it. It's difficult.
And I think that, part of what the debate is while we need to look at this from the perspective of an athlete who is gender non-binary and the opportunities that should be afforded to that person, I think also you have to look at it from the perspective also of a cisgender female who's on that team, who looks at that team as providing opportunities for her, and those opportunities may be diminished or more difficult when you put a gender non-binary male to female athlete. And so I'll just give you an example, and that's how it translates to track. So in track and field, a male who runs two flat in the 800 is a pretty good high school athlete, but average. Mm-hmm. If you run that time as a female in high school, you are probably in the top 1%, not even 1%. You are better than most female pro athletes at a two flat. And so that's why, and so if you are a cisgender female on that track team and you've been running 210, 212, which is a national high school level, and all of a sudden, a 159 athlete comes on and it's a male who identifies female, now your opportunities have been diminished because you've gone from being the best athlete on that team, but now you're not that anymore.
Right.
And I think that's where the push is happening. And I think that's also where with that Connecticut case, I understand the Department of Education has made some finding under Title IX that to allow a male to female gender non-binary athlete to participate on the female team would deny the opportunities to the females. And so it would be a violation under Title IX. And that's going to be litigated in the courts. And, I'm not competent enough to tell you how that's going to play out. But I know that that's an issue that's ripe right now.
Yeah. I think when we get really in depth in this conversation and we talk about competitive fairness, it's important to remember, and this is something I've learned with the people I've worked with in therapy, and also the people who have been so courageous to share their lived experiences of their gender and their experiences related to that, is that while there may be questions about competitive fairness, we have to remember that these are humans, and it is really difficult to believe that anyone would choose to go through the process and the difficulties that they face in their gender identity just to have some sort of competitive advantage. And so it's really hard, I think, and I've read this in some of the responses from the participants in our study, this idea that high schoolers are going to start to change their gender identity just to get some sort of competitive edge. I mean, do we know that that would never happen? No, we don't know that. But people, and especially children, experience a lot of discrimination and a lot of difficulties when they go through the process of affirming their gender identity or changing their gender identity. And so, I just want to bring that in because it's easy to talk about sports and competition, and we do need to remember, like, these are people. And as we're talking about high schoolers, like, these are kids.
Yeah, they are. They're kids.
Yeah.
And any kind of discrimination towards this entire group is very painful to me. And it's one of those things, for people that are on the edge or are afraid to say that they also want to treat them with fairness and kindness. I think about what it was like for people in the United States prior to the Civil War as it related to slavery. And let's say you are born into a situation where that's the way of life. You're the white person. That's what your family does. That's what all of the friends around you do, and it's accepted. Yet you have this feeling inside of you that says, this doesn't feel right. But your parents are okay with it, and everyone else is okay with it, and everyone else is either silent or just complicit with it. And you just ignore that feeling. Well, it's one of those things that this is a new frontier that we're facing in our current time and culture and place.
Yeah. And, you know, I totally agree with that. And I come back to something in the very beginning when you so honestly shared, and I think with a lot of humility, of like, oh, we're all learning. Like, we really are. And I wanted to mention, too, a few things I recently read from the Human Rights Campaign. And this speaks to, again, how serious this is. Like, when we're talking about gender identity and how people are treated, that poverty, homelessness, substance use, suicidality, these are things that people face that can be related to their gender identity, especially when they experience family rejection. And in relation to intersectionality, which means the different ways that people's cultural factors and identities intersect, this is especially difficult for people who are Black or people of color. And from the stats on the Human Rights Campaign, in 2019, there were 26 deaths of Black transgender people. And in 2020, already there's been 12. And I know at the beginning of your podcast, you so eloquently dedicated this to George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery. And I want to mention Tony McDade. That's a Black trans man who was killed by police on May 27th, 38 years old, in Tallahassee, Florida. And there's so many aspects of that that are so sad. And another aspect is that he's been misgendered continuously by the media.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's just such a larger context to this. And, you know, we're talking about it in the sports context. And I'm also, it's really resonating with me what you spoke about as far as considering our own spheres.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, and I hope when Sam and Dana, Victoria and myself, when we're able to disseminate our research more widely, that these coaches and athletic directors, you know, we can all understand that wanting that competitive fairness. And like, we have to see the people that these statements and these views and, you know, there's potential for discrimination. We have to just keep coming back to like, these are people. And, you know, in sports, that's their sphere of influence. Like, their leadership can be so powerful there.
That's right. Coaches have such an influence.
Yeah, and I think that as a coach, and I do some coaching, but I haven't coached a team, but I know that it'd be interesting to see the team, you know, dynamic that happens when you have a gender non-binary athlete participate. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see how that, you know, unfolds within the team dynamic and being, you know, the tolerance of that. Because I know, you know, when you put this into the sports realm, I think people can be, you know, when they're in the classroom with someone who's gender non-binary, I think there's a level of acceptance and tolerance. It's easier to be that because you don't feel that the person is getting an advantage over you.
Right.
When it comes to the sports realm, it's different. And so it's tough. You say, hey, I'm very tolerant, you know, outside of, you know, the track with, you know, gender non-binary, I support the causes. But when you're talking about taking away my scholarship or my state championship that I was training for, then it becomes difficult. And I guess, you know, what I would ask is, you know, what do you say to, you know, sort of the cisgender female who all of a sudden says, wow, my opportunities now don't seem as big as they used to be because now we have a gender non-binary male participating who just took my spot.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you get that person to sort of feel, hey, this is providing opportunities for everyone?
Yeah, I think that is such a great question. And I imagine there's a lot of different ways to answer that question. Where my initial thoughts go, and again, I don't want to take away from the value of competition. I was a head high school coach for several years. And yeah, of course, especially at the varsity level, like you want to win, you know? And there's something larger, there's something bigger about sports. Like, what are these other values that we can cultivate through our sports and we can embrace through our sports. And we can be something so much bigger than winning or losing this event if we choose to and we practice being inclusive and prioritizing opportunities for everyone. And that, you know, and again, like, I don't want to take away from that loss or that win, but I think for the other athletes on the team, there is an opportunity for these much bigger wins.
I want to say thank you to you and to Neil for this wonderful, interesting conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. I so much appreciated the conversation, and I really appreciate you welcoming this topic into your podcast.
Thank you for sharing it with everyone. Thanks for your research and to your graduate students. And I hope you'll come back again, Kendall. And there's so many topics within sports psychology that I'd love to talk to you about.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kendall. And I look forward to hearing more about your research as you mine the data that you're getting.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Neil. Thank you both.
Sure. Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode of Psychology America with Dr. Alexandra, show your support by leaving an awesome rating on iTunes. If you'd like to share your comments or ideas about this podcast, follow us on Facebook under Psychology America. Lastly, Dr. Alexandra has written an inspiring children's book entitled There's Always Hope, a story about overcoming, which is beautifully illustrated by Brianna Giasullo. There's Always Hope, a story about overcoming, teaches children about finding joy and gratitude, even when things don't go exactly as planned, and can be found at psychologyamerica.com or amazon.com.